to another episode of The Sound of Economics, the podcast by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. My name is Maria Demerzis, and I'm the Deputy Director at Bruegel. I'm joined today by a very prestigious group of experts to discuss the macroeconomic outlook in Europe as we see it today. Let me first introduce my guests, Elena Rybakova, who is the Deputy Chief Economist at the Institute of International Finance based in Washington. Welcome, Elena.
Thank you so much. It's great to be in this fantastic company.
Absolutely. Christian Odendaal, who is the Chief Economist at the Center for European Reform based in Berlin. Welcome, Christian.
Well, thanks for having me. Thank you.
Absolutely. And then finally, our very own Gregory Claes, who is a Senior Fellow here at Bruegel based in Brussels, just like I am. Let me then start with the economic outlook in the most recent macroeconomic forecast exercise that the European Commission has just published. The European Commission is forecasting that growth in the EU is going to be at the rate of about 3.5% for 2021. This is positive to begin with. It's not negative. So quite clearly, we are in a bounce back. But the European Commission is also very cautious to say that the uncertainty that surrounds this forecast is enormous. And it's an uncertainty that is across different dimensions. Not only is the number very uncertain itself, but it is also that the degree of the recovery, the speed of the recovery is going to be very different amongst different countries. And that, of course, is an important point as we try to design the architecture of economic policies as we go forward. Now, what's your original thoughts on this? Do you agree that the degrees of uncertainty perhaps nullify the forecast? Or do you think that there is still a good forecast on which to base the forecast? Gregory, maybe we can start with you.
Yeah, I'm happy to speak about this. Yeah, actually, what strikes me when you look at the forecast is now they have really three scenarios. They have like the baseline scenario, and now they always have like a best scenario and a down scenario. So they really think about it that way. And I think, yeah, the baseline scenario, yeah, it might be the best of what we can do best in terms of forecasting, but we should not be complacent because, as you said, there are big risks. In Europe, some of the risks are already materializing, actually, like the slow rollout of the vaccine, which will lead to a slower recovery than in the US. So I think it's important to not only have a baseline scenario, but also have this down scenario, because given the high uncertainty during this pandemic, we can pretty easily fall into the lower scenario.
It's very interesting to say that because, you know, in the good old days, the different scenarios usually had an attached probability to them, right? And, you know, when you talked about the baseline scenario, you were talking about, well, this is what we think will happen, but of course, you know, with certain probabilities. Both the European Commission, but also the European Central Bank has moved away from this probability-based kind of design of scenario. Quite rightly, in my view, there's no way that you can assign probabilities here. But you do have a baseline scenario. I would call it a middle scenario. And then you have a very pessimistic one and a very optimistic one. Christian, how would you differentiate between the three? And you know, when you are designing policy, should you really design policy based on the middle scenario or should perhaps design policy based on your degree of risk aversion?
Well, that question is difficult to answer without an epidemiologist next to me because a lot of the recovery really depends on non-economic factors. I mean, it used to be that, you know, economic forecasting was difficult because of the complexities of how economies operate and interact. And now we have a pandemic on top of that, which means that the job of forecasting the economy is really heroic. But we do need some form of conceptual thinking about what the economic implications are of the different scenarios. As a politician in such a pandemic, I think I would go off the worst case scenario and think about what are conceivable policies in that worst case scenario and what prevents me from implementing them. Because we've seen again and again that sort of somewhat more optimistic views on the course of the pandemic have been shattered. I think that, you know, what Gregory said, the slow vaccine rollout is something that I don't think anybody would have predicted in, say, September, October or so. And now we have a vaccine campaign which will take us into the fall of 2021, right? So I think as a policymaker, I would take the worst case scenario and think about policies in that worst case scenario and then think about whether there's really anything that prevents us from implementing that.
Yeah, so you always say, Christian, you know, hope for the best, but prepare for the worst, right? I mean, I think that's, I don't know if this is a principle for designing policy, but it probably is a good principle to design policy in the current juncture. If I may turn to you, Elena, and I want to sort of go to the US and perhaps come back to Europe. The US, because we have had a very active conversation over the past few weeks, given the Biden support package that was put forward, $1.9 trillion, on top of what was given earlier on. Later in the year by the previous administration and, of course, at the beginning of the pandemic. you know, there the discussion was very much exactly on what Christian said. This is too big. I mean, is it just too much? Is it the degree of risk aversion here far too big? And what kind of risks it entails? What kind of lessons do we learn from the US in the way that the US has responded? And I'll come back, of course, to Europe, but we learned for Europe. Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Well, I think all the rage this last couple of weeks in the US has been the size, the composition, and the financing part. So these are the key issues. And the size, as you say correctly, it's almost double the size that everybody was penciling in early in the year. So it is almost 2 trillion. You know, we started maybe around 1 trillion, and it is a good, healthy, you know, +7% of GDP. And depending, of course, on the size of the multipliers, it will have a very meaningful effect. So this is on the size. In terms of the composition, many worry that it is very much on the current spending. So a chunk of the extra spending that's been put through is extending the unemployment benefits or giving this sort of the cash payments to individuals. So a big chunk of this additional spending is for the current expenditure rather than medium-term infrastructure. And the concern is that it is coming at the time when the economy is doing pretty well already. You know, after sort of the lukewarm quarter of the last year, you know, this year the numbers have been sort of so far very strong. And we just talked about the vaccine, the numbers encouraging there as well. So I think that is the concern. And finally, on the sort of the debate on the financing and, you know, sort of the issue here is if the rates that continue going up, if the Fed is indeed challenged by the markets, which we're seeing now, is that sustainable? You know, you will have higher issuance and already sort of the higher pricing of the Fed hikes at the time when the markets are a little bit frothy. And I think that's where the sort of the tightening of the financial conditions is a concern.
Can I zoom in a little bit? Because I think this composition of the package and what we learn from the US would be also an important component. It's interesting that the US economy is actually doing very well. But is this an accurate description of how the economy is doing? I mean, one of the things that we hear a lot about is that, you know, there are certain segments of the economy that are doing very well and others that are not. So, you know, can we design policy to meet that average, if you like? If this performance of the economy is very much driven by the top segment of the distribution, does this thing really allow for us to design monetary policy when actually there's a segment that is doing very bad?
Well, you put your finger exactly on the key issue. You know, as I was preparing for this podcast, I was thinking, well, we're going back to old-fashioned economics where we have the average temperature in the room and then we praise ourselves, you know, that, yay, you know, we have the big package and the average GDP is growing fantastically and the numbers are great. And we seem to have, again, completely forgotten about inequality and, you know, sectors, sort of segments of the of population and sectors of the economy that are not doing so well. And whether they will be successful in sort of in reviving those sectors of the economy and helping people, you know, we just talked about many kids being out of school for so many months, right? Improving productivity over the medium term, I'm not very hopeful. However, what they're trying to do is that the cash handouts are the easiest to give to everybody here, right? So with the cash handout, you're going to reach everybody. It's not the best case solution, but, you know, it is something. So that's one. And on the composition, as we know, there are very strong partisan issues in Congress, and ability to pass a credible infrastructure package is just very difficult. It is possible that we'll hear about the second package, you know, the budget going through later in the year. And it's likely the Democrats will try to negotiate a bit for longer for bipartisan support. We'll see what happens there. And, you know, in the pre-campaign trail, Biden was talking about, you know, big infrastructure spending. So let's see if they succeed. But, you know, I do find it will be very challenging.
So this issue of dispersion, effectively, in the way that we design the policies, one that we should perhaps come back to. And I think we should also when we come back to Europe. Gregory, if I can come to you. First, do you have any thoughts on the US package, on this discussion? I know we had a lot of talks amongst us at Bruegel, but do you have any additional things to say? In particular, if you wanted to say something about, you know, how are we going to experience this surge of policy in the US back in Europe? Are there any spillover effects that we should worry about? Economic or otherwise, I mean.
Given the size of the package, I think there will be spillovers for sure. And it can go through different channels. The first channel, of course, is the most direct channel, is the trade channel. Of course, fiscal policy of this magnitude will have an impact on aggregate demand from the US. And given that Europe is one of the most important exporters in the US, I think 20% of manufacturing import in the US come from Europe. It's actually good news for us because it should have some positive impact on our export. So that's the first more classical channel. The second channel could go through the exchange rate, actually, because if we have a very quick rebound of the US, it could have an impact on the dollar. The dollar could appreciate substantially. And generally, actually, this has some undesirable effect. Maybe Elina actually should talk about this, because generally it's more on emerging markets that it has a negative effect because they borrow in dollars, etc. In Europe, we are kind of insulated from these bad consequences generally, thanks to our own monetary policy. So in that way, I think higher dollar and weaker euro could also be a good channel for us and good news. But of course, there is a third channel that, which I think is important and which Elina already kind of mentioned, the interest rate channel. The fact that interest rates in the US have been increasing quite significantly, and that in turn, we also had an increase in the interest rate in Europe by an equivalent amount, like 30 basis points in the beginning of the year. And of course, if the ECB does not do anything about that, then it could be dangerous because, as I said at the beginning, we are already lagging in terms of recovery compared to the US. So if we have tightening financial conditions, it could really derail our recovery. So I think the ECB needs to be cautious and really use PEP in order to insulate us from this increase in interest.
But derail the recovery or perhaps negate the positive effect coming from the exports that you just said that will go up? I mean, it's very difficult to know.
I would say that the trade effect will take more time. The interest effect might come right now. So in a way, I think it's important to deal with the interest effect right now.
But I mean, if I make it, and Cristina, I'm sure you want to come into the discussion. I mean, the debate in the US, a lot of the debate was on the inflationary impact. If there was going to be an inflationary impact because it's so big, if there is an inflationary impact, surely that would make the currency depreciate, not appreciate.
It depends what the central bank does.
Absolutely. But I mean, I'm not talking about the reactions because the reactions could be all there. But I mean, you know, the first impact effects, I have never really understood what will happen to the exchange rate, at least on impact. They'll have policy reactions coming to that. But I mean, you know, I have very early in my career, I have stopped trying to predict exchange rate movements. I think this is an advice that I would give to anyone. But Christian, did you want to add something on this?
First of all, to agree with Gregory on sort of the, I think this provides an opportunity for Europe to support its own economy as long as the ECB sort of counteracts this passive tightening in financial conditions. And the strength of the euro used to be a bit of our headache, right? In 2020, nominal effective exchange rate of the euro is the highest in I think a decade or more. And so, you know, a strengthening of the US dollar in this regard on the back of a stronger recovery in the US doesn't necessarily need to be a problem for Europe and advanced economies. Of course, emerging economies, Elina will know more about this, they will struggle with a sudden shift in US policy and particularly monetary policy quite a bit more. But what I find most interesting about the US stimulus plan and the recovery is sort of what we can learn for our own design of post-COVID policy, right? So there are a couple of open questions that I think the US is now giving us a sort of experiment to answer. And one is, of course, what is the immediate spending effect once this pandemic ends? So is there a sort of huge pent-up demand coming online, which leads to a proper boost to consumption and the overall economy? Or is it rather sort of that, particularly the upper part of the income distribution, they have acquired quite a bit of saving during this pandemic. But what we know from past, you know, wartime savings, right? It was not necessarily the case that people just drew them down right away and, you know, went on a spending spree in the next 12 months after it ended, right? It just meant that the rich people had more of their savings and could sort of lower their savings rate over future years, right? And so it's not necessarily something where, even though, you know, there will be some form of post-COVID boom, obviously, because people can spend suddenly. This is very much an open question, how strong this rebound will be and how much those who could acquire additional savings can spend it. And in turn, how much have incomes and balance sheets of poorer households been hurt so that they cannot go on a spending spree right after. So these are the sort of balances of factors that I'm curious to learn from the US experience, because that very much should inform our policy here in Europe too. And on the question of whether the stimulus is too big or whether it will cause inflation, from a European perspective, what strikes me is this idea that a one-time stimulus package should lead to sort of sustained inflation, right? My first thought was, well, I wish we in Europe had those problems, right? So of course, there is a sort of, if that really stimulates a strong catch-up demand right after the COVID pandemic ends, if it does end in the way economists think something like that ends, right? So this is an open question. But if that does lead to such a post-COVID boom, okay, we may have a bout of inflation, but for a sustained inflation, there are a couple of more ingredients that we need, right? We need tight labor markets. I think we learned from the US and Europe in the last decade that, you know, how tight labor markets need to be to properly generate wage growth is quite a bit tighter than we used to think. And there needs to be some form of de-anchoring of inflation expectations, right? And this is, in my view, the main point. And it's really hard to de-anchor inflation expectations that have been ingrained for so long. I think also the last 10 years sort of teach us that, particularly in Europe. We've really tried to anchor inflation expectations lower than 2%, right? And failed, right, for a long time. And it took a long time until inflation expectations moved down. And Japan is the opposite. They have tried with a lot of spending to anchor them higher. Again, extremely difficult once they are anchored at a certain point. And then you would need to assume a central bank that accommodates all of that for an extended period of time. Now, I've been on the record of arguing for overshooting on inflation to make up for past undershootings of inflation, but not in my wildest dreams would I expect the ECB to suddenly accommodate sort of an inflation rate way above target for an extended period of time for us to de-anchor our inflation expectations in Europe. These are the sort of questions I have from a European perspective when I look at the US debate.
Yeah, Gregory, you wanted to add something?
Actually, on the point about the slack in the labor market, I think this is really a great experiment that the US is going to run, at least for us economists, because there was a lot of uncertainty about the output gap in the US. A lot of people were saying, okay, the output gap in the US was closed because unemployment was at 3.5%. But actually, when you look at prime age employment in the US, it was lower, like 5 points lower than in the UK, than in Germany, than in Japan. And it was even lower than in France, actually, which has a huge structural unemployment. So I think we don't know where the output gap was before, and therefore we have no clue what the size of the output gap today. So I think testing that limit is what the Biden plan is going to do, and it's a very interesting experiment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's exactly, and it comes back to the point we were discussing earlier with Elena. I mean, that this is, you know, the idea of looking at the average at this point. The average, by the way, of a measure that is difficult to measure in the best of circumstances because of the, you know, it is not something that we actually measure the output gap. We have to put a lot of theory in it. But also in the context of a very unequal distribution of the effect of the pandemic, it just makes a double whammy of difficulty of using these types of excess demand, of excess capacity to design policy. And we'll come back to the inflation, and I just because I think it merits, certainly in the context of the EU more than the US, it merits a little bit more attention, and I will come back to that. But I wanted to ask you, Elena, if you wanted to add anything else on sort of the global context, if there is something, any other lessons or any pressures that we see that may be relevant in the context of the world economy that, of course, will translate in the EU.
Well, I wanted to follow up on the savings debate that Christian started, because why are we having this level of savings? How is it broken down by different buckets of income? And also, given the better social safety net in Europe and sort of smaller dispersion in terms of incomes versus the US, whether people will react differently. And exactly, we already made that mistake in the US post-2008 global financial crisis, where we're thinking, wait a second, savings rate is going up and up and up. Where is the end? We're looking at the average. They must be spending any moment now. And then it turned out that for lower parts of the sort of income distribution, they are desperate, right? And I'm worried that we might have exactly the same situation where the high income will spend a bit, but then will choose to keep on saving for a while because we've adjusted our, you know, patterns permanently, while the sort of the lower part of the distribution is completely desperate and doesn't have any of those savings. And I'm very curious how having and not having better social security net in Europe versus the US will make that experience extremely different on the recovery side. So that's probably on the global, that's more of a question rather than an answer.
But an important one, yeah. Well, I mean, let's bring the discussion then back to Europe. And here, I mean, I think that's what we learned from here. I mean, we have not had an extra fiscal package in Europe, but I mean, you know, the question is, do we need one? And given what we know now, which is very little about the end of the pandemic, you know, how would you design fiscal policy? You know, how would you do it? How would you measure this demand, this excess demand capacity? How would you differentiate between the different parts of the distribution? And I'm glad you brought up the savings rate. I mean, the data for the savings rate show that savings rate in the EU has gone up by 10% in the pandemic. At the same time, we know that coming into the pandemic, one in three households were self-reported to be financially fragile. Financial fragility in the context of, well, I can't meet a sort of a medium-term expense like, you know, a hospitalization or something like that. One in three households in the EU. And by the way, the EU has got a good welfare system, right? I mean, some countries, this was as big as one in two coming into the pandemic. So, you know, even in places like in continents like the EU, where we are very proud of our welfare system, we do have financial vulnerabilities that will play out in the way that this policy support is designed. So let's come back to the fiscal policy, since this is really the next big question. You know, is there a need for an extra fiscal package? Gregory, I'm looking at you. I'll come back to Christian for this. Yes, no. Yes, for a fiscal support. And does it carry any risks?
No, as I was saying, I think, we are lagging in terms of recovery with respect to the US. If you come back to the forecast you were mentioning at the beginning, Europe is not going to go back to its pre-crisis level before mid-2021 at best. And in the down scenario, it's even in 2023. And if you look at particular countries like Spain or Italy, they are not going to be back to their pre-crisis level before 2023. So I think, we need to avoid making the same mistakes that we did last time during the previous crisis. And I think having a more aggressive fiscal policy is extremely important. And I think, it's a no-brainer in my view.
Okay, no-brainer. So let's think about this. So we have temporarily suspended the rules in the context of the EU. What do we do next? Do we go back to these rules or do we just simply ignore them and use fiscal capacity in whichever way is appropriate till we have the pre-pandemic recovery? Christian?
Well, this will be sort of the question we will be debating for at least then for this year and next. I think it's relatively clear that it will take time until we can reinstate fiscal rules at the national and at the European level. I think it would be a mistake to focus on fiscal rules that have proven to be inadequate in the past. And now you add a pandemic on top, you add a very uncertain recovery from the pandemic on top, you add COVID-related public debt to debt levels of highly indebted countries on top of that. That doesn't make the fiscal rules more adequate, it makes them less adequate, right? So the question is, are we willing politically to invest a lot of political capital into reforming the rule book? I think that will be very difficult, but it's absolutely worth it to have that discussion. And in the meantime, we need to find pragmatic ways in dealing with this, right? And there are a couple of ways we can envisage how that could happen, right? We know that, for example, the excessive deficit procedure in the fiscal rules of the EU allow a bit more flexibility, right? But do we have the political will to basically put the entirety of the EU into an excessive deficit procedure to make it sort of politically acceptable? I'm not sure. Fudging the rules in a way that allows sort of the rules to apply, but, you know, give countries more grace periods. Maybe there are sort of flexible ways. I'm not a lawyer, so I cannot comment on how much they fit into the legal framework, but some ideas could be, well, the COVID-related debt should not count towards the debt reduction targets, for example, right? Or we could suspend the rules and sort of invoke the general escape clause for a couple of more years, but come to a political agreement as to how the transition path to reinstating the rules should look like over the next couple of years, something like that, right? But to me, it's quite obvious that we need to find a pragmatic solution that puts the recovery of the European economy first and the rules second. Because I think if the US, we really should be glad that the US is experimenting with this, not just, as Gregory says, from the point of view of nerdy economists, but also in terms of overall policymaking, right? Because it shows, I think one of the most striking things this shows us is that fiscal policies does matter very much so. Right. And yeah. I think this is an important contribution to the debates we're having. I think in terms of the timing of the fiscal policy, what Elena mentioned in terms of the US, is the US stimulus coming at the right time? In our case, you know, our social safety nets and sort of the national support that governments have been giving to households and businesses have stabilized European economies. But the economic forecast, I'm taking the median scenario now from the European Commission, shows a relatively slow recovery under 2021, particularly in the services sector and in countries that have large tourism sectors, right? So is there a need for an additional short-term boost, and which would need to come probably at the national level? I'm not so sure. I'm open to persuasion there. I would think that, you know, stabilizing incomes of households should be priority number one. And we know from at least some of the data that we're having is that the rich are building up savings and the poor hardly can. And so supporting their incomes, I think, is also in light of what we want the recovery to look like after this, I think should be top priority. And if countries are not doing enough on that, I think we should encourage them to do so.
So I think we are converging towards arguing that, I mean, not that we need to converge, but I think we are all saying that I think fiscal policy needs to be a lot more targeted, right? I mean, it makes no sense to support households for whom the savings have gone up in the past year. But it makes a lot of sense to try and support firms who will then sustain employment for poorer households to stay in employment and have a continuous income. So, I mean, you know, the design of fiscal policy at the national level is going to be important. But Christine, you raised two issues, which I think we should really ponder a little bit on when it comes to the fiscal rules. The discussion on whether to come back to fiscal rules or not is just beginning at the EU. So it would be important if we could just, you know, inform that debate. So two issues there. Should we come back and when? And what should we come back to? Right. I mean, so you talked about, you know, should we invest in our political capital to try and redesign rules, or should we just not and, you know, get on with it in a pragmatic way and then think about this in the longer term? I think it's important to think about both of them because I think they will feed one to, if you, to the extent that you believe that fiscal rules are really not very good, then why are we spending time thinking about coming back to them? You know, I mean, I think they're not totally independent from each other discussions. But okay, you're quite right. I mean, the amount of political effort that we need to put varies. But can I ask both Elena and Gregory if you can give us your thoughts on this idea of the timing? But also, what should we come back to? I mean, to the extent that fiscal coordination makes sense, we need to have some sort of fiscal coordination. You know, what type of fiscal coordination should we have given circumstances? Elena?
Well, I think on the fiscal, I was listening to everybody, and I don't want to jump the gun, but I think we do need to think about funding for European fiscal deficits or debt sustainability over the medium term. We might not need to think about it this year, but we should probably start thinking it at some point. And Draghi's government in Italy sort of made, you know, for now, the market's conditions better. But Europe, with its big funding needs, is sensitive. It started, but it doesn't yet have a common framework for financing fiscal deficits, and it doesn't have the privilege of the being sort of the first reserve currency that the US has. So I think the fiscal sustainability concern is there. And we've seen more of a discussion of sort of like a risk-based approach to fiscal sustainability analysis, where, you know, the probability of the spikes in funding costs, you know, whether that that should be incorporated more explicitly rather than saying, oh, we're going to do this, our typical debt equation with this interest rate. We need to look at the frequency and the size of the spikes, and that might have to inform our debt sustainability analysis. So in the short run, my concern is that, you know, reaching the sort of the intelligent fiscal policy design, you know, we do need to spend, we need to continue spending, but whether with reaching the right households, that's my question, especially at the national level with their own political priorities that maybe are not fully aligned. And the last one, in terms of what we're coming back to, I think a lot of big frameworks in Europe that were relevant 20 years ago are probably no longer relevant. And just like we're having the policy review for the Fed, for the ECB, we might actually have to do a policy review for the fiscal rules and also maybe incorporate a little bit of a more common funding framework in there, as controversial as it may be.
It's actually quite interesting you raised the issue of sustainability, because one of the things that actually I have observed is that, contrary to, let's say, 2010, this discussion about fiscal sustainability is second or even third order. And I mean, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge the fact that there is a priority to spend. But we mustn't also forget that there will, at some point, budget constraints, they need to halt. And, you know, there is just no way around that. And I think it's important to keep it in discussion, even if we agree that it's not immediate priority. But Christian, before I give the word to Gregory, you wanted to make a small intervention or?
Yeah, that was about the funding for European governments. I think one of the good things about this pandemic was that we tested the ECB's resolve to be the lender of last resort for European governments, right? And I think the ECB has passed that test with flying colors. So I think the ECB as a lender of last resort, even though they wouldn't ever call it that, right, is now firmly established. And I would think that the worldwide demand for safe assets would not necessarily decline as a result of a pandemic, but usually just grow. Because on top of the risks that we saw, geopolitical and otherwise, comes climate change with even more urgency in the coming decades. And now on top of that, we may be entering an age of pandemics. So it seems to me that the demand for safety for whatever your amount you want to store has only increased. And so that's why the combination of sort of the ECB as a lender of last resort and the increased amount of safe assets, I wouldn't be too worried about the funding costs. The German government was recently asked by a parliamentarian at what point Germany's debt servicing costs would reach zero. And the German finance ministry said, well, on current interest rates by 2029. So basically, from that point on, Germany has no debt servicing costs whatsoever, right? If interest rates stay the same. So I think if you look at how debt servicing costs for a country like Italy or Spain have developed, or France and Germany for that matter, right? You would think, well, those two countries since 2008 have quite diverging paths of fiscal responsibility, right? And the debt servicing costs of France and Germany are just very, very comparable, right? Almost the same, right? And so that's why I think is I'm less worried about sustainability. I know I'm reversing roles here entirely because I'm the German in this conversation, but you know, I have to say it's just I'm not too worried about that.
I'd like to come back to the ECB actually, but not before we hear from Gregory on his views on fiscal rules. Particularly Gregory, if you could tell us a little bit, you know, about this, what kind of rules should we go back to? Because I think, you know, even if we don't have it immediately, it would be important to know what our destination is.
Yeah, no, I think it's an important conversation to have. On the timing, I think we should leave ourselves a bit of time. I think we should suspend the rule for one more year so that we have enough time to discuss what kind of rule we want to go back. On the specific of what rule we should go back, I'm not sure we should already discuss that. Actually, I published papers on what fiscal rules we should go back 6 years ago. But maybe we should discuss first about what should be the objective of those rules. Because the objective might have changed. We were discussing sustainability. It was the overarching objective before. Now we also aim for stabilization. But now we also aim in a way on incentivizing countries to spend towards some priority of the EU, like to green their fiscal policy, etc. So there might be good reasons actually to discuss about the objective of the fiscal rules. So I think we should first have a consensus on this. Why do we need fiscal rules? What do we want them to achieve? And also we should go also on first principles about them, like what could we do in terms of variables that we use? For instance, I think we should definitely move away from unobservable variables in those fiscal rules. For instance, let's drop structural deficit or let's drop output gap from the fiscal rules. So I think first, before we propose one particular rule, I think it's important to discuss the objective, what have been the past problem with past fiscal rules, etc. And then when we have all of those principles, then we might end up with a good fiscal rule. But I think it's not yet the time to focus on one particular rule, but to focus on principles.
And of course, when it comes to the, I would say, short to medium run, we also have the New Generation EU Fund, who is going to contribute to fiscal policy. That gives us a little bit of space to think a bit more carefully about how to use the national fiscal policy and to what purpose, right? And I mean, that also would be part of the conversation, at least for the medium term. I know the New Generation EU Fund is not a permanent tool, but at least for the next 7 years, it would be a relevant tool to consider. I don't know if you had any thoughts on this, Gregory.
Yeah, no, I'm a bit more skeptical than you, maybe. I think, yeah, it's great to have this. It's great to show that we can have common debt, etc. But on the fiscal space that this provides, I think it's fairly small.
Well, it varies from country to country, right? And I think it's important to acknowledge that. For some countries, it will make a big difference. I mean, it will amount to 10 percentage points overall, cumulatively. No. It's not immaterial. For other countries, and of course for net contributors, it will be less interesting. Okay, well, listen, I would like to also, maybe as a final thought, unless there is something you want to raise yourselves, come a little bit about the monetary policy side of it. Because, you know, I mean, the role of the ECB, as Christian said, has been extremely complementary to the fiscal policy, right? Because it has really allowed countries to go out and borrow and preserved the possibility of financial fragmentation. This is relevant for the EU and for the Eurozone because of its architecture. It's not something that the US is or other countries are doing, the fragmentation part, not the supportive part. Now, and there, I would like to talk a little bit about the inflation risks and, you know, what you think about the possibility of inflation coming back. There's a very interesting intellectual debate on this issue, but I also like to bring it a little bit closer to home. What would it mean if we were to have inflation back? would or would not jeopardize the ability to use fiscal policy effectively, which was also part of the debate in the US, right? It was very much exactly on this. If it were to be inflationary, the Biden package, it would really destroy the good things that the fiscal package was going to do or not. Gregory and I looked at the expectations that the markets have based on inflation swapped contracts. And, you know, if you redraw this sometime at the end of January, which is the last time we looked at it, there is basically no inflationary impact. The markets are acting as though there's no inflationary impact in the US. There is something, looking at the data for Europe, there is inflation impact this year, which is entirely due to very specific purposes. There are no other inflationary impacts. So there really are two questions here. Do we really think inflation will come back? And if it were to come back, would that be a problem for the ECB's role and actually the recovery at large? Maybe, Elena, if I can start with you.
Yeah, I think on inflation, we're so used to inflation not coming back. You know, it's been many years. And I think the risk is here that market is very much positioned in terms of allocation of portfolio equities versus fixed income, is come completely away from any expectation of inflation, apart from the short-term market pricing in right now. So I think that's why it's so painful. It's such a low probability but high cost event that market is sort of struggling with it, because they will not be able to reallocate portfolios if suddenly inflation were to come back on a sustainable basis. And it's also ironic in our conversation is that now it appears fiscal policy is responsible for inflation, while the monetary policy is responsible for financing fiscal deficits. We are talking in the US about inflation. Why? Because of the fiscal, right? And maybe they will manage to deliver inflation, which we haven't seen in a long time. On the other hand, of course, Fed has been very careful to say that we'll be very cautious. You know, we're not going to rock the boat. And it's now the ball is in their court, as you say, was market pricing to actually try to convince the market. No, we don't see yet the risks. We're going to stick to our average model, the new average inflation model, and we're not going to do it in any foreseeable future. And I think in the end, I think that's what's likely more will prevail. We might have some pickup in inflation in the US. It will likely be temporary and moderate. And then in the meantime, Fed will manage to convince the markets that, you know, that they're definitely not hiking before they're tapering. You know, that's also a little bit ahead of themselves. In terms of Europe, I think, and I'm really curious to hear your views, because I think there is more of a question that whether we're measuring inflation adequately, you know, maybe the housing prices are going up and we're not paying attention to that. But the inflation, the way we measure now and the sort of the system, the way it is now, I would be extremely surprised if we have a pickup in inflation anytime soon, if ever, you know, in the history. And then just finally, the rate action that we have seen, the sort of the steepening of the curves, if that stays, it actually helps you a little bit on the banking system, particularly in Europe, right? So it also could have inadvertently some positive effects as well.
So, Gregory, what do you think about the Fed's ability to tolerate inflation, were it to surge?
The Fed?
Fed. No, the Fed, and then we'll come back to the ECB, because, the inflation risks are really in the US, given the package.
As we were saying before, and I think it was Christian who said that, I think the inflation impact coming from the Biden plan is going to be temporary. And I think, yes, the Fed is going to let that play out because it's going to be temporary, especially now that they have moved to an average inflation targeting framework. For the ECB, I don't know. Let's see what the framework review does. Actually, a few years ago, I remember with you, Maria, we advocated for a kind of average inflation targeting framework for the ECB. I still think it would be great for the ECB to do that. But in a way, it's not that far from what they've been doing. If you look at average inflation since the beginning, since 1999, I think they are not far from 2%. So they have been
a little bit above it. A little bit above it. They're still above it. And remember, their target is below. But close.
Yeah, but they are not so far. So in the end, in practice, it would not be that different. I think it would sends the right signal, but in practice, it might not be very different. And to your question about will inflation come back in Europe, if we have to think about a median scenario, as we were doing before, I think, yes, it's not in my median scenario, there will not be inflation. I think, yeah, as we were saying, the recovery will be slower than in the US, as there will be still slack, because there was still slack even before COVID. So in my view, yeah, inflation is less of a problem in Europe than in the US.
And in fact, if you look at the inflation swaps, even for the EU, the numbers are really there. You know, there is a blip this year, maybe next, because of the reasons that had caused disinflationary effects during the first year of the pandemic. But as soon as they peter out, then you come back to a conversion rate of about 1.5, 1.6. So really, there isn't a risk of inflation. So I'm very much of the same camp that the risk of inflation is not material. However, I would like to say that where to come back inflation, it will be embarrassing for the EU and for the euro area. And the reason for that is, or at least awkward. Remember, there is a monetary policy stability at this objective, and then there is a financial fragmentation objective. You know, if the ECB were to opt to go for the preserving financial fragmentation, financial unity in the EU against the principle of financial of price stability, it will be going against its own mandate. So the two objectives will be antagonistic. For the moment, they're not antagonistic because they're not, there's no inflation. But if inflation were to come up, it would put the ECB at an awkward position. And in fact, if I may ask Christian here, as the resident German in this group, we have had the ECB being challenged before, right? I mean, the proportionality of policies. Here we talk about, and I'm talking about the incidence of inflation and an ECB that it opts to maintain financial unity in the euro area. You know, is this perhaps another excuse for the ECB proportionality to be challenged? And, you know, that would be, again, a difficult thing for the credibility of the euro area. And, you know, these are maybe low probability events, but very high impact events in the language that Elena used.
Well, let me entertain the idea of having inflation in Europe. I quite like that idea, so I would love to entertain it. And so if we do have inflation, and in Germany, inflation goes above 3%, say, right? Of course, that will be sort of headline news every week, right? Because this is sort of a policy issue that the Germans place probably a bit of disproportionate importance to. I think when it comes to whether this constitutes a violation of the ECB's mandate, I think that the mandate, in my understanding, is wide enough to accommodate even a temporary overshoot of inflation. If it didn't, if price stability, as is the mandate, right? The operationalization was later. And so, you know, the mandate of price stability in supporting, in second order, the overall economic goals of the EU, I think very much accommodate a temporary overshoot of the inflation. One of the things that Gregory said, that inflation since the start of the euro has roughly been around 2%. Yes, but, you know, over the last 10 years, it's not been, right? Over the last 10 years, inflation has been, or last 7 years, I think, has been around 1%, right? There was no legal challenge then that the ECB violated its mandate of keeping, you know, prices at a roughly 2% trajectory. And so that's why I think it's not going to be a legal problem. It will be sort of a political problem, of course, right? If the ECB is perceived as conducting monetary policy for countries other than Germany. But I think it's important that the ECB sees through that and considers this sort of common European interest. I think the ECB should have learned its lesson from 2008, 2011, and 2018, when three times over one decade it tightened too early, right? Or it tightened prematurely. And I think this is the lesson that, in my understanding, the ECB has learned, that it wants inflation to be properly re-anchored around 2%, that it is willing to tolerate a bit of above target inflation. And I think this is a sort of a general shift in policy towards more state contingency, right? So we want our policies to be based to be state contingent, that we're only changing policies once we have reached our objective, right? And this is what has been bothering me about monetary policy for a long time, and about fiscal policy too, is we didn't seem to have any sort of higher goal in mind. We were talking about numbers and sort of this QE package has 500 billion. I think, okay, the QE package of 500 billion is not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in, can you get inflation back to target? Or fiscal policy, right? We're thinking about debt levels and deficit limits and so forth. What is our larger objective? And this is what Gregory very rightly said. We need to talk about what are the guiding principles of our policy. What is it that we really want to achieve? And this is a discussion in the fiscal policy range, but also in the monetary policy range, I think we need to be having. And I'm fairly confident that we are seeing the start of exactly that debate in Europe.
Wonderful. Listen, we're coming closer to an end. I mean, you know, I always like to finish these types of conversations with a prophecy. I mean, you know, try and look into your crystal ball, let's say, in September of 2021. I'm picking September because this is what is the date we're aiming for, sort of have achieved a big numbers of vaccination. You know, when we do a forecasting, how do you see the next microeconomic forecast look like in the EU? Do you think it's going to be a better one, or do you think it's better than now, I suppose? And what do you see? I mean, you know, to the extent that you can, what do you see the risks associated in if we fast forward to September? Elena, I'll start with you. One final thought. The easy questions for last, as you can imagine.
The easy questions. I always used to listen to the podcast while biking to work. So I do think by September, we might be again coming back to the office. My concern is, in terms of the forecast, is that many people will just find their jobs permanently destroyed by September and they will have nothing to come back to. And we will need the economy possibly hotter for longer in order to be able to draw them back into the labor market and also into the economy. So that's my concern.
So there will be good reasons for more fiscal support. Thank you, Elena. Gregory?
No, yeah, I think in September we'll need to think about the next phase once people are vaccinated. Now we are talking about supporting households and companies during the pandemics. At that point, we'll need to think about the next phase, and maybe in terms of fiscal policy, we'll need to think about how to boost investment, for instance, on how to use this negative R minus G to invest in R&D, in education, to do public investment in order to support the recovery. I think that would be the right thing to do.
Yeah, under uncertainty one day at a time, right? Or as you say, one phase at a time. Very, very wise words. Christian, you have the last word.
Well, the last word is for me to look towards the US, right? In September 2021, we will have a lot of information about how the US economy recovery and stimulus played out. And this is sort of what gives me a bit of optimism, is that the faster vaccination campaign and the boldness of both the Fed and the fiscal policymakers in the US will provide a lesson for Europe to go bold to. And I think this is sort of my typical German optimist thinking.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's a good line to finish with. Thank you all very much for joining us from different parts of the world. It has been very interesting. I mean, you know, the uncertainties are still rampaging. There's a huge uncertainties. I hope policy design takes that into consideration. At this point, I think we need to wrap it up. Thank you all for listening. And you can find all our products at Bruegel.org. We look forward to hearing from you in the next episode of podcast. And for this moment, thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.